Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we go from banks that are too big to fail to the biggest election on earth taking place right now in India. More young voters have swelled the rolls, and half a billion people are expected to vote in the next 5 weeks. And it's not just a big election, it's important for India. So Indian Americans, call in and tell everybody else why this is interesting. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. These elections go on for 5 weeks. Why is that? What do we need to know about these Indian elections? What's at stake for the world outside of India? What's at stake for the billion Indians? 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, joining us now is Marshall Boughton. He's interim director of the Asia Society Policy Institute and former special assistant to the U.S. ambassador to India. Welcome to WNYC, Marshall Boughton. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
This is the world's largest democracy, and voting is taken very seriously in India, but it's a complicated system, and voters aren't selecting candidates exactly. They're casting ballots for political parties. So can you give us a little background on how this works?
Right. Well, it's a little combination of the two. It's a parliamentary system, so they are voting for candidates who are associated with particular political parties, and the outcomes are determined by the number of seats in the parliament that each party gets. And to form a ruling coalition, to form a government, one party or a coalition of parties has to assemble 273 seats, or one seat more than the majority in the Indian parliament.
And India has seen tremendous growth in the last decade. You told my producer that this election is about the politics of scarcity versus the politics of aspiration. Fascinating. What do you mean by that?
Well, for five decades, India suffered from what a prominent Indian economist called the Hindu rate of growth. That is a very low 3.5% growth, which barely stayed ahead of population. And politics were about allocating out scarcity. In a poor economy, in a very low-income economy. Now the politics have changed to ones of aspiration. In the last decade or two, Indians have learned that they can have better lives for themselves and their families. Thanks to the growth that was generated mostly in the last decade as a result of reforms over the previous 10 years. But, and very important, but in the last 4 years, the Indian economy has slowed tremendously from 8, 9, 10% only 3 or 4 years ago to less than 5%, likely to be the number this year. And that's been accompanied at the same time by very high inflation, fiscal deficits, scandals, and so forth. And the Indian voter is really looking for another option to restore the economic growth of the past.
Indian American listeners, tell us what's interesting about the massive elections taking place in India now and for 5 weeks. 212-433-WNYC. Tell everybody else. You talk about this among yourselves. Tell the rest of the New York community what's interesting about the elections in India. 212-433-9692. Why should everybody else care? Akash in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hey, Brian. Good morning. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I was just talking to your screener regarding the amount of money being pumped into this election. That has become a major issue. I mean, at least from the way I see it, the so-called black money, the hoarded money with the tax evasions and everything. So there is no transparency in India yet. And there's one new party which is trying to change it. But from the two big major parties, the one in power and the main opposition party, there's no absolutely no transparency, and I think that has a trickle-down effect once whoever comes in power in the government. I think that's the root cause of the corruption, because whoever is pretty much investing in the election, they will try to gain it back. That's my point.
Thank you, Akash. Marshall Boughton, want to comment on that?
Well, I think your caller is exactly right, and that's one of the big issues on the agenda for the future of Indian democratic politics. And it's become such a big issue, as he says, because over the growth of the last 10 or 15 years has poured a lot of money into politics and also into illicit activities by politicians. But there's a growing awareness in India of this problem. And I think in due course, just as the United States is turning back towards big money in our elections, I think Indians will turn eventually towards more transparency and more control over the role of money.
Now, there's a candidate who has really taken up that message of aspiration as opposed to scarcity. Narendra Mori, a former tea seller who's now the face of the BJP, that party. What's his platform?
His platform is basically economic growth and better governance. And he comes after many years as chief minister of a state, which has been very successful economically. And he speaks to the aspirations of especially of young Indians, of the roughly 115 million Indians who are eligible to vote for the first time in this election. He's not an uncontroversial figure because of his alleged role in the, or at least acquiescence, in the terrible violence that occurred in Gujarat, directed mostly at Muslims now 12 years ago. So it's a very interesting choice that many voters are making. But I think there's also a desire to repudiate this government over the government of the last 5 years, the UPA's two so-called government led by the Congress Party, which on all those scores, lack of economic growth and corruption scandals and so forth, and just simple failure to govern effectively.
And here is a Mori supporter calling in, Harry and Elizabeth. Good morning, Harry.
Hi, Brian. I listen to your show. I listen to your radio show every day.
Thanks so much.
I have one thing to this, is that Narendra Modi, I understand whatever he had in 2001, the riots that they had, he was proven innocent and all that. He had clean chits from UPA government, which has been the forming party right now. I believe strongly that he's going to be a very good prime minister candidate, and he's going to, once he wins all those electoral votes, he'll be the perfect candidate for the United States as well. The reason why is because he's pro-government, he's pro-economy. I know a couple, because I come from the same state that he's from, and everyone is so upbeat about him, and I come from the same town, which is Vadodara, where he's getting elected from. And everyone in our family and in all Indian society, we strongly believe that if he is in the power, he'll bring greater good to the common people of India. And it's going to benefit the United States in such a way that he went to China a couple of times, South Korea a couple of times with his policies. And he has a couple of good infrastructure projects under pipeline right now.
So let me ask you to expand on one piece of what you said, because if you see Mori as the candidate of economic growth, which is good for a lot of poor people in India, and also good for the United States, how are the interests of poor people in India and the U.S., which is so much more affluent, how do those interests coincide?
This is a perfect example. A couple of years ago, he signed up a contract with Bombardier, which is a Canadian company, and he told a Canadian company that, listen, I have no problem you coming in, just make sure that you set up plans. And he is so pro-economy that he made sure that the land was subsidized in a fair share way. And then when Bombardier came in, they started manufacturing the subway trains, which are now used in Mumbai and Calcutta and everywhere. And he knows that the only way he could lift people out of poverty is if he gets more jobs in. Now, you know that IT jobs are in most of the South India, and all the manufacturing jobs, he's trying to bring it to the western part of Gujarat. And he had a manifesto that came out 2 days ago. In the manifesto, he broke down line by line what his alignments are, what he's thinking to do in the next couple of years. And that's the reason why I strongly believe that he's one of the best candidates out there right now. And we're talking about UPA government, which is full of corruption for the last 10, 15 years. And it's like the same family trying to run the country, which is now has 1.2 billion people. And 1.2 billion people need a stronger candidate and not someone who's going to, you know, bow his head down to terrorism, you know?
Hari, thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go right on to Rama in Princeton. Rama, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is a little more general. I grew up in India, and actually, now though, I've actually lived for longer in the United States than I lived in India. I feel a sense of pride, I would have to say, that, you know, such a large country with so many problems, we still have, you know, these elections, and we are able to conduct them, and we are able to throw the people that we don't want out. And, you know, I've heard this said often about the American democracy that, you know, it's really impressive to watch the peaceful transfer of power. And I guess that's how I feel about India as well. But I had another statement that I wanted to make here.
Uh-huh.
Why is India's democracy successful, considering, you know, the poverty and all of that that exists there, where, you know, we see many other democracies try and fail? And my guess is that it's how the democracy was achieved, in terms of it was a grassroots upswelling that, you know, happened from the people. It wasn't externally motivated. So it wasn't that there was some other big power telling us that, you know, that democracy is good for you. It was more that people felt it. And they worked at it, and it took decades to achieve it, but it worked because it was so hard-earned and because it came from within, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean, and Rama, I love your big think statement at the beginning of your call. We take so for granted the peaceful transition of power in countries like the U.S. and India that both have it, when there is so much violence just to figure out who's going to be the next ruler in so many parts of the world. And Marshall Bruton from the Asia Society, what do you think about her theory as to why it's been able to persist in India despite it being overwhelmingly a poor country, which has been, you know, a root cause of violent upheaval in so many other places in the world?
Because democracy was the only way that India, such great ethnic, religious, linguistic, and cultural diversity could be governed. And its founders, including Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, understood that very fundamental fact and committed India to democracy. And as Rama said, that commitment arose out of a 50-year-long independence movement, which was from the grassroots up to the elites. And it took hold in the Indian consciousness. And we saw this in the 1977 election, which is arguably the other much more consequential election in India's long series of free and fair elections, where Indira Gandhi's emergency and abrogation of democratic process was rejected soundly and by the Indian voters. Today, the choice is not between democracy and no democracy or less democracy. The choice is between an India that whose economy grows, whose people look to better lives through their own education and efforts, than an economy, as I said, of a polity of scarcity. So this is a very consequential election. That said, let me just point out that none of us should take for granted at this point that Narendra Modi will succeed and become the prime minister. The big unknown in this election is that the regional parties, the parties that represent in broad terms many of the states, will still gain a very large share of the votes. And they have to be persuaded to join a coalition led by the BJP. A lot will depend on just how many votes the BJP and its own allies get.
And
if they get fewer than 210, then it's a dicier proposition as to whether he succeeds.
We had a Maury supporter call in. Here is a Maury detractor. Paula in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, thank you for having me on. I just wanted to point out that the kind of soft consensus here that's, you know, coming out about Modi as a kind of moderate pro-growth visionary in terms of India's future is one that, you know, is largely contested by many, many parts of the Indian public and many people of Indian origin living in the U.S. Modi's culpability in the massacres against Muslims is not a small, you know, caveat to a pro-development policy. This is a significant issue for a country with a large Muslim minority, and his responsibility in that, I think, should not be underplayed. And the other issue is that this kind of notion that economic reforms have been sort of a win-win solution in India is something that's contested in India deeply. And so this election is not just about contesting corruption, but contesting inequality, which has been the outcome also of liberalization, which has seen tremendous growth, but also tremendous inequality. And the response to that in the Indian context is a complex one. It isn't one that I think we can simply explain through, you know, terms like accountability, transparency, technology, etc. So I think that, you know, these are complex issues. But one thing that is not complex is Modi's culpability in Hindu nationalism. And this is a great worry and a great concern for many, many people, both in India and outside of India.
Paula, thank you. That's such an important call. So, Marshall Bruton, I mean, Maury's personal background, obviously controversial. If you think he was complicit or personally responsible for some of the anti-Muslim riots, even if it was 12, 13 years ago, that does not go away. If you or your people were the victim of that and you think he's one of the perpetrators, also his whole party, the BJP, is considered a Hindu nationalist party. His opponent, Rahul Gandhi, said on Sunday that if the BJP wins, it'll mean that Hindus and Muslims will be pitted against each other. So what do you think the implications of that are? Could it mean renewed tensions with Pakistan or more discrimination against the Muslim minority in India or more flare-ups in Kashmir if BJP, never mind Modi in particular, get into power again?
Well, first of all, it is, as one of your callers pointed out, there was actually investigation by the UPA government, but by the Supreme Court. A special panel of the Indian Supreme Court conducted a very thorough investigation of the riots in Ahmedabad and came to the conclusion, at least, that Modi should not be considered guilty of direct complicity or involvement in the riots and the anti-Muslim violence. That doesn't necessarily exhaust, as Paula points out, the concern about his perhaps acquiescence in what happened. But the truth is nobody knows. And under Indian law, he is not considered at present guilty of anything. That said, she's absolutely right that he is a highly controversial figure. Now as to the role of the BJP, let's remember that the BJP led a governing coalition in India for 5 years, from 1999 to 2004. Now, some things went on during that period under that government that many people of a liberal, more liberal mind objected to, and I, in my personal view, with good reason. But overall, that government led by Aviva Chai did not indulge in the kind of communal attitudes and discrimination and incitement to violence that many people are concerned about. At the end of the day, the test is for Narendra Modi. Will he eschew the more militant, hateful politics of the extreme wing of his party and its predecessor organizations, or will he lead from the center? And I think if he succeeds, we can only see what happens. At the end of the day, however, the Indian voters, Indian public, will reject any politics of communal antagonism over time.
Let's hope.
Just as they rejected the politics of of anti-democratic process in 1977.
Marshall Booten, interim director of the Asia Society Policy Institute and former special assistant to the U.S. ambassador to India. This is an election that's supposed to involve like 500 million people. This is not exactly, you know, the runoff for New York City Public Advocate in terms of the number of voters. And it goes on for 5 weeks. So we will check back in later on in the process. Listeners, if you're interested in that, stay tuned. We will come back to it before the voting is over. And Marshall Booten, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.